From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. They are cleaning up today in Vancouver. Last night, disappointed hockey fans rioted, sending nearly 150 people to hospitals with injuries and leaving downtown streets littered with debris and broken glass.
The trouble started shortly after the Vancouver Canucks lost Game 7 of the Stanley Cup Finals to the Boston Bruins. Hundreds of angry fans and others set fire to police cars, overturned vehicles, and broke windows in more than 50 stores. Looters were seen fleeing with everything from makeup to a store mannequin. Police then moved in with riot gear and tear gas.
Vancouver's mayor, Gregor Robertson, blamed the violence on a small number of hooligans.
It's absolutely disgraceful and shameful and by no means represents the city of Vancouver. We've had an extraordinary run in the playoffs here, great celebrations, and what's happened tonight is despicable.
The mayor, police, and ordinary citizens have been quick to point out the success Vancouver had with last year's Winter Olympics. Perhaps with that in mind, thousands of Vancouver residents signed up for a volunteer effort to help clean up the city. A Facebook group called Post-Riot Cleanup, Let's Help Vancouver, attracted more than 14,000 members this morning.
Of course, the scene was very different last night in Boston. The Bruins, one of the NHL's original six teams, won their first Stanley Cup since 1972. And as Kurt Nickisch of member station WBUR reports, fans there couldn't be happier.
The sports bar The Fours outside the Bruins Arena gets its name from the number four of Bobby Orr's jersey. He led the Bruins to their last two Stanley Cups back in the 1970s, and beneath framed and fading jerseys of that era, people wore bright black and gold ones to cheer on today's team. When the Bruins scored, you could feel the place shake. The Bruins were winning the way Bruins teams have always won, by playing hard-nosed hockey, scrapping out goals like the head-first slide that put the Bruins up 3-0. That's when Ken Molino and Eddie Poulin realized it was actually going to happen. They're both from Nahant, Massachusetts, where Bobby Orr lived when he played in Boston.
You never thought it was going to happen again. They've just broken your heart so many friggin' years. And we've been waiting a long time. A lot of these kids tonight, they've only been following them for 10 years, 15 years, but we've been waiting a long time to have it back in Boston.
When the final seconds ticked to zeros and the Bruins hoisted the Stanley Cup for the first time in 39 years, people poured out of the bars into moonlit streets like sand spilling from a broken hourglass.
Just everyone singing and dancing and crowd surfing, it's unbelievable.
Jesse Sklarz just shook his head, playoff beard and all, knowing that his blue-collar Bruins are the best.
There isn't a better team to represent Boston, in my opinion, as far as just hardworking, you know, just like grinded out hockey, you know what I mean? Now the Red Sox, we got all the big bats now, football, we got Brady, but the Bruins, it's all, you know, it's a bunch of no-names, and we finally did it. It's unreal.
Unreality is what Boston fans woke up to this morning. Their major sports teams have now won an incredible 7 championships in 10 years.
What do I press that right there?
This morning, bleary-eyed fans beamed for pictures in front of a statue of Bobby Orr. One fan was wearing the championship hat he bought before he had his first coffee.
It's a blur right now.
Boston is still a hockey town, says Tom Collins, that's also the home to the Red Sox, the Celtics, and the Patriots.
Whether it's hockey, basketball, football, or baseball, we got the best sports town in the world. Proved it last night. Completed the cycle, so to speak.
Envy Boston. The major sports team here, now suffering the longest championship drought, is the New England Patriots. They haven't won the Super Bowl in 6 whole years. The humanity. For NPR News, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Boston.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Jerry Brown, the governor of California, has told the state's legislators to try again to come up with a new budget plan. Today, Brown vetoed the budget that lawmakers passed just yesterday. And doing so leaves a lot of questions about California's ability to pay its bills this summer. John Myers of member station KQED covers the State House in Sacramento and joins us now. Hiya, John.
Hello, Robert.
Jerry Brown's a Democrat. The state legislature is controlled by Democrats. And it was a Democratic budget that he vetoed. What happened?
You'd think everything was fine. Yeah. I mean, in a nutshell, This was a budget that Brown believed broke a central promise of his campaign for governor last year, which is no more gimmicks. You know, Jerry Brown has spent the entire first 5 months in office trying to send a package of taxes to the ballot for Californians to vote up or down. It's about $11 billion of income, sales, and vehicle taxes that are set to expire on July 1st if that doesn't happen. But he could never get Republicans to go along, and it takes a bipartisan deal to place this on the ballot. So Democrats yesterday gave up on that. They removed the taxes from his budget and put some other creative fixes in it and sent it to him. And today, in a video that we all saw posted on YouTube, Jerry Brown made it pretty clear that this plan, in his words, only delayed the day of reckoning.
California is facing a fiscal crisis, and very strong medicine must be taken. So I am vetoing it today because I don't want to see more billions in borrowing, legal maneuvers that are questionable, and a budget that will not stand the test of time.
So, John, what happens now? First, can lawmakers override the veto, or do they have another plan?
Well, they could override it technically. I mean, the last governor to have a veto overridden was, yes, Jerry Brown in his first go-around. But an override takes a supermajority vote, and Republicans hated this plan almost as much as Jerry Brown did, so that's out. There's a lot of talk of what happens next, a plan B, a plan C, because this actually wasn't even the first preferred budget. But again, it's going to have to be something that has these long-term fixes that Jerry Brown wants and also can get Republicans to go along with the tax issue, which Brown says is really critical to getting the revenues and getting the voters to approve those revenues.
Jerry Brown has had a reputation since the 1970s as being a very unconventional politician. It sounds like he's living up to his reputation.
It does indeed. I mean, you talk to people who've known Jerry Brown over his 40-some years in state and national politics, and they say at 73, he's more focused, much more so than he was back then when he was governor. You know, Brown has marched to the beat of his own drum, and I think a lot of people saw that across the nation in some of those quixotic runs I think you'd call for president. And so here's Brown saying, I'm not back to make nice with my fellow Democrats or interest groups. Democrats have a different story on that, I should say. They think Brown is making a mistake here. They think he's being too much of a party of one. But I think it'll be very interesting to see how the public, how Californians react to Brown saying, look, I don't want to play the games. I just want to solve the problems.
Well, California, of course, has had year after year of late state budgets. Can its finances withstand another political logjam?
I think in a word, no. The state's controller has projected a cash flow shortage sometime in mid to late summer here in California. If they don't have the cash, you could get into a situation of the state having to issue IOUs. And what California needs is really what I think you could call a payday loan from Wall Street, some kind of bridge loan. But the investors in Wall Street have made it pretty clear that if there's not a budget in place in California, then that loan can't happen. And so I think that that Jerry Brown and the California legislature, given how little they agree at this point, they've got a lot of work to do in a very small amount of time.
Okay, we'll stay tuned. Thank you, John.
You're welcome.
John Myers is the Sacramento Bureau Chief for member station KQED. Now, author Ben Dolnick encourages you to take a front row seat at a bittersweet comedy. For our series You Must Read This, we enter the world of child actors, which you might call an old-fashioned version of the TV show Glee. Here is Dolnick's reading recommendation.
Penelope Fitzgerald's 9 novels are thin enough that if you were so inclined, you could take her entire literary output down from the shelf with a single stretched hand. You'd be holding an eclectic bunch. There's the murder mystery, set in a museum of ancient artifacts. There's the one about an 18th-century German poet and his love for a not-very-bright 15-year-old. And then there's the one I find myself going back to again and again, the one that taught me that it's possible to get sadness and humor into the same book and even the same sentence. That book is At Freddy's. At Freddy's takes place in 1960s London, at the Temple School for Child Actors. It's got a plot that makes you feel sorry for the people who have to write summaries on the backs of books. Reading it feels like wandering through an actual school. Now into the back office where the headmistress, Freddie, is wheedling a caller into donating a set of old carpets. Now into a classroom where Pierce Carroll, a first-year teacher, is failing spectacularly at managing his room of precocious pre-adolescents. The tour is so lively, the characters you encounter so vivid and funny, that it can take almost half the book for you to notice that your pleasure contains the germ of another feeling, heartbreak. Because remember Pierce Carroll? It turns out that he's only sticking around, despite knowing he's no good as a teacher, because he's fallen in love with the other new hire, Hannah Graves. And those histrionic brats, trading impersonations in the back row. One of them, Gianni, is too poor to stay at the school. Another, Matty, is so jealous of his more talented friend that he may be losing his mind. And as for Freddy herself, whose every speech is such hilarious, bullying fun, it turns out that the Temple School is in serious danger of being shut down. Love, fear, class, ambition, even death, it's all in here, but so elegantly presented that you finished your plate before you even think to ask about the ingredients. When I first read it, Freddy's, I was struggling with my own writing, particularly with how to write about a sad subject, the death of a parent, without writing an entirely sad book. At Freddy's gave me hope that such a maneuver was possible. Yes, terrible things do happen, her book seemed to say. Hearts break, people die, happiness withers. But since there's nothing you can do about it, you may as well laugh at the Grim Reaper's dress in the meantime. The events in Fitzgerald's books are enough to make you weep, but the manner in which she presents them, the warm brilliance of her descriptions, the fond exactitude of her dialogue, sends you out of the Temple School feeling oddly hopeful. I closed the book, thinking I might have found a solution to a problem in my writing. In the months and years since, I've continued to pick it up, and I've become convinced that its wisdom, its method for both facing and resisting despair, could be applied to a great deal more.
Ben Dolnick is the author of You Know Who You Are and Zoology. You can find the entire You Must Read This list at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
Now to another essay in our series marking Father's Day, which is this Sunday. All week we've heard commentary from guests and friends of the program reflecting on the joys and challenges of fatherhood. Today we hear from Jay Rapp. He's an educator who adopted his now 7-year-old daughter, Kendall, as a newborn.
In 2002, I was 34, single, and living and working on the campus of a co-ed boarding school in Colorado. Not unlike many others, there were two things that I wanted more than anything. One was to be in a committed, loving relationship, and the other was to be a father. After years of trial and error, I finally realized that finding my soulmate was beyond my control. I had already begun looking into the possibility of adoption the year before. Through a friend of a friend, I met a couple who recommended a private adoption agency outside Chicago. I vividly remember my first visit with my social worker, who was absolutely wonderful. After asking all the required questions, she looked at me long and hard, sighed, and said, "I have one more question for you. Are you a practicing heterosexual?" My response was simple and to the point. As I said, "At the moment, I'm not practicing anything, but if you're asking if I'm gay, I am." And that was that. The remaining two visits went smoothly and were uneventful. What was eventful, though, was the time it took between completing the mountain of paperwork and the actual placement. It had been a year since I had heard from the agency, and when they finally called, it felt like the single greatest moment in my life. A pregnant mother had come in to sign the papers, giving up her soon-to-be-born baby, and I was the next on the list. By the next week, however, she had changed her mind, dealing me with the worst moment in my life. But just days later, the adoption agency called again, informing me that the baby had been born, a beautiful girl, and if I was still interested, she was mine. I was on the next plane to Chicago. I vividly remember holding her for the first time and the love and fear that I felt simultaneously. It was an important lesson that to this day, I tell couples thinking of starting a family. That thinking about being a father or a mother is very different than being a father or mother. I instantly wondered what I'd gotten myself into. But after a few months, thankfully the fear subsided and I settled into the joy and contentment of fatherhood. Like so many parents, I found myself just watching her sleep, calling everyone at her first smile, her first word, and espousing her many talents. My daughter has been, is, and always will be the greatest gift I ever received. As it turns out, I did find love, and we have since adopted a second child, another girl. On this Father's Day, I could not be more grateful.
That was Jay Rapp, an educator and dad to adopted daughters Kendall and Kelsey, reflecting on Father's Day.